Welcome to Ellisons Connect, the official podcast by Ellison Solicitors, where we bring together expert professionals from a wide range of areas to discuss key developments and trends. Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of Ellison Connects. In this episode, we will be discussing border protection. What's it all about? I'm Spencer Davis, Business Development Consultant, and I'm joined by my colleague Anne Coutts, Senior Associate within our Wills, Trust and Probate Department in Chelmsford.
Hello.
Hello, Anne. Right, what's it all about, court of protection? Tell me.
Okay, so the court of protection are responsible for deciding whether someone has the mental capacity to make good decisions themselves. And if they aren't, they have the power to appoint a person to manage a person's affairs for them.
So you say the courts appoint somebody, not the person who's giving the powers?
The person isn't capable of giving the powers, right, because they're mentally incapable at that point.
So who makes the judgment? How do you decide whether I have or have not got capacity to make an LPA, power of attorney?
Well, an LPA and power of attorney is a completely separate topic. And if you want more information on that, episode 9 of the Ellisons podcast is all about lasting powers of attorney and capacity you may or may not have. The court of protection only steps in when somebody doesn't have capacity, and the decision for that is made either by a medical practitioner or by independent social workers. In all circumstances, have to complete an assessment, a mental capacity assessment, confirming the person is mentally incapable before you can apply to the court of protection.
Is that quite tricky? I mean, is it a long process for a medical profession to assess my capacity?
Well, it's normally a one-on-one assessment. Unfortunately, we are finding less and less GPs and local practitioners willing to do that. So we do often have to turn to independent social worker companies to provide that service to us.
And is it actually the courts that actually take control, or is someone appointed to act on my behalf?
No, it's not the court itself. So you make an application to the court, and it can either be a family member, it can be a friend if considered close enough, or it can be a professional who applies to the court, and the court appoints that person to be the deputy.
Right, you say singular there. Can you appoint more than one person?
No, it can be more than one person. However, if you have multiple deputies, that's obviously multiple people who need to make decisions and sign off accounts and deal with the day-to-day finances.
Okay, it's been set up. What powers does that person have? Can they just take care of everything on my behalf?
No, the court will dictate what powers you do and don't have. A general court order normally includes such things as the power to run a person's bank account, to run their financial affairs. It doesn't normally include the power to sell a property, and you normally have to go back to the court of protection and ask for a specific power to do that. But that's normally given if it's needed on behalf of the person who's mentally incapable.
Right, I suppose if someone's in a nursing home and have lost capacity and a property needs to be sold to pay for their care, that's when you go back to the court of protection to ask for authority to sell and dispose of the property to pay for the care. Was that
absolutely right? And that's a classic reason why a property would need to be sold, would be to pay for somebody's care.
And do the, what do you call the person, by the way, has the power?
The deputy.
The deputy,
you
right.
You are appointed as a deputy.
Okay.
Under a lasting power of attorney, that person's the attorney. But obviously in these circumstances, because the court has appointed you, you are the deputy.
Do I have to produce evidence of what I'm doing? I mean, if I'm paying bills and paying nursing home care fees, etc. Otherwise, there's a lot of responsibility. There's a huge amount of trust in the deputy. Does anyone oversee what they're doing? Does anyone check?
Absolutely. Once you are appointed as a deputy, the court will charge you a supervision fee once a year because they will require to see your accounts, which you have to keep fully up to date, justifying all the decisions you've made and why you've made them. And also any investment decisions you make. If you've sold a property, that all has to be justified through your accounts every year.
So in theory, I'm audited once a year to make sure that the decisions I've made on someone else's behalf are all okay.
You are. And the other thing you have to do is you have to maintain a deputy bond whilst you're a deputy. It's kind of like an insurance policy, but not really. But what it does is it protects the mentally incapable person, that if the deputy were to run off with their money, they would be protected and that money would be replaced to them. However, the deputy bond company will certainly come after the deputy for the criminal activity of stealing the monies. So you don't get away with it if you're a deputy in that way.
Without getting too technical, on a point of liability. If I'm looking after someone's affairs and I've been appointed a deputy and monies need to be invested, I'm reliant on a third party. You go to wealth managers or what have you. Is there a sort of protection if that went horribly wrong, or if bonds and investments didn't perform? How much liability is there actually on the deputy? Even though they've done everything right, they're reliant on third parties for advice.
As long as you can show you've taken independent financial advice, you've justified why those decisions were made, it's really as though you are managing your own affairs in that regard.
So you mentioned about properties being sold. What things can't a deputy do? Is there anything that they need to go back to the courts for and say, look, you know, this is outside of my remit, I need extra authority? Does the Court of Protection cover everything that's needed to deal with someone's affairs?
It really depends what you've applied for in the first place. When you make your initial deputy application, you can either make a general application.
What's that mean?
It means that you just want to take over the property and financial affairs, and there's almost a standard order the court has, which allows you to manage the finances. There are circumstances where you may need more on that initial application. For example, you know you need to sell the house because there isn't enough funds to pay for care, for example. You can ask for permission to sell the house in that first order.
Apart from, for example, paying bills and just general shopping that the person might need, can the deputy make gifts on behalf of the person they're representing? I don't know. Grandchildren, Christmas presents, birthday presents?
They can, but this is actually a really strictly limited area, and you might actually need to go back to the court for permission to do so. By law, deputies can make gifts only if it's either to a family member, friend or acquaintance of the mentally incapable person on a customary occasion, or to charity. But it's essential the gift is of reasonable value to the estate of the person. You have to consider their current needs and how generous they maybe have been before and can be now. You have to consider what would their wishes, views and values have been before they became mentally incapable, and also what family members and friends think they would have wanted to do.
I suppose it always depends on how much money is in the account as well, because obviously as years go by paying nursing home fees, if that's what you're going to be doing, that's going to start to dwindle. So situations will obviously change, I assume, over the years.
Absolutely, they will do. But classic examples are customary Christmas gifts to grandchildren, birthday gifts. If a mentally incapable person, you can see from their bank accounts, had a direct debit set up for a charity, that can continue. If you want to make larger gifts, because perhaps you're thinking of inheritance tax planning for the person, or a family member comes to you and says, I would like a new house, at that point, you have to go back to the court for special permission.
Hence, that's why things are audited on an annual basis.
Absolutely.
Okay, right. You talk about capacity, sort of changing the subject slightly. If some parents have got a child with special educational needs, obviously, whilst that child is a child legally, the parents will make a decision on their behalf. But when that child becomes an adult, the parents can no longer make a decision for that individual. Is this something the Court of Protection, does that help those people in that situation? Or is it only for example, elderly people that maybe with the onset of dementia? Does it work at sort of both ends of the scale?
No, your mind instantly does go to an elderly person who's been diagnosed with an illness which is causing them mental incapacity, but you're completely correct. Children with special educational needs, when they become adults, their parents lose their right to help maintain their property and financial affairs. So the Court of Protection has no age limit, and we often work with parents of special educational needs children when they are in that transition from childhood to adulthood.
So remind me, when does someone become an adult? What is it now? Because as far as I'm concerned, it's 30, you know, but
try 18.
18. So for parents, at what stage should they be preparing for this? Because if they wait till 18, that child's in an adult and decisions need to be made, but mum and dad can't spend their money or the benefits are coming in. So do they need to do this well and truly in advance?
It used to be around a year, but they have now taken applications online, which seems to have sped things up a little bit. And we're now averaging around about 14 weeks, which is obviously quite a significant amount of time if you can't have access to somebody's finances. For example, if they're in a care home, care homes often aren't willing to wait that long to be paid. So what you can do as part of your application to the court, you can put in a emergency application, which will be dealt with on an interim basis whilst the main application is going ahead. Classic example is care fees need paying, or for example, a house may have exchanged contracts and it needs to be completed. They would be regarded as emergency applications and the court would deal with them on a very specific basis. So for example, for care fees, the court could order that a bank can pay the care fees directly. So the money doesn't go to the deputy, it gets paid straight from the bank to the care home whilst the main order's coming through. Or they will authorise that the house can proceed to completion, but the funds cannot be used until the main order comes out.
You said about the bank paying direct. Does a deputy actually go onto the bank account under normal circumstances, or does the money come to them to pay the bills, or do they become does it become a joint account between the person that's in the nursing home and the deputy?
No, once someone's being appointed a deputy, the account actually goes into the deputy's name, but as deputy for.
Right.
So for example, it would be Anne as deputy for Spencer. There's another category of persons who are often sent for deputies under the Court of Protection, and that's somebody who has had an accident. A classic is a brain injury where they can no longer manage their affairs. Now, that can be obviously anyone of any age, and often the Court of Protection will actually appoint a professional deputy in those circumstances to protect the needs of the person who's mentally incapable versus the need of potential beneficiaries in the future.
Right, you say professional. What is a professional being us, you know, a law firm? Is that what you call a professional? Is it a doctor? Is it a medical person?
No, a professional deputy is often a solicitor in a law firm who is appointed by the court to protect the mentally incapable person's finances on an ongoing basis for them.
Because I've never given any thought. So when we've got a medical next team, so if someone has had an injury or an accident and there's been a substantial payout, that money needs to be kept safe to ensure that person has everything they need for the rest of their life. And if they're a young person, it's important that the Court of Protection is set up to ensure that they've got enough money to survive the rest of their life.
That will have been clearly considered when their compensation was given. Sometimes it can be a family member who's appointed as a deputy in those circumstances. And if there's an appropriate person, that's absolutely fine. But often there isn't an appropriate person, or due to a potential conflict in the future, that is when a professional deputy can be really effective.
Right. So I understand elderly people that have lost capacity, young people with special educational needs, but also people who may have had a brain injury or an accident, etc. What's the next step? So what's the process? And why I need to sort something out. Do they come and see you? How long does it take? Is the court's costs expensive?
Well, the first step would always be to get professional advice and help in that matter. We really can't do anything without that COP3 mental capacity assessment. So that's often the first stage.
And do you organise that, or would I go and get that on behalf of my elderly relative?
We would absolutely assist you in organising that. Ideally, it would be the person's GP or medical practitioner who they are under, perhaps for their mental incapacity. But unfortunately, if that is not an option, we can assist with obtaining independent social workers to help with that. Average fee for that is between £400 and £600 for an assessment. But like I said, you can't do anything in the court without that. There's then numerous forms you have to fill in, which that's my job to help you with. The one people find a little bit tricky is you have to outline the full income and expenditure of the person with mental incapacity. Now, that's very easy if you've been managing their affairs in the past. A little bit trickier if you don't know that person's financial affairs and you have to go into their house and dig through all their financials to find that information out. You then have to declare that you are a suitable person to be a deputy. That means you cannot have an insolvency agreement. You cannot have been made bankrupt. And you really do have to declare that you're going to act in the best interests of the mentally incapable person. The other one, you have to notify a minimum of 3 people you're making the application. They have to ideally be close to loved ones of the person who has mental incapacity, but it can be absolutely anyone who would be interested in their welfare. So it can be their doctor, it can be their carers, it can be their financial advisor if there's no one else, but just somebody who is looking out for that person and ensuring that the deputy is the right person.
You say financial advisors. I imagine situations where wealth managers and financial advisors have been looking after someone for a number of years and they've got assets and funds squirreled away earning them an income. It gets to the point where if someone's losing capacity, they can't have that relationship anymore. So the Court of Protection steps in to make sure that those investments are still being looked after so I still have my income.
Absolutely. And your deputy would be given the authority to liaise with those people as well. Right.
One of my final questions, I suppose, on someone's demise, so when they pass away, does the deputyship's duties cease then and then an executor takes over, or can a deputy still carry on paying outstanding bills and debts, etc.?
No, your responsibilities end at that point and the executors of the will, if there is one, take over at that point. You do, however, have a few more things you have to do to finalise your role. You have to file final accounts with the Court of Protection. You have to account to the executors for what you're handing over to them. And it's actually for the executors to then square up any outstanding liabilities that may or may not be in existence at the date of the person's death. An interesting one on somebody dying, though, you might want to apply to the Court of Protection for a statutory will. If someone you are assisting hasn't made a will, for whatever reason, whilst they're alive, you can actually apply to the Court of Protection for what's called a statutory will. And that is an application to essentially create for them a will that they didn't create for themselves.
I didn't know that.
There might be reasons to do that. Inheritance tax planning is one. A disabled beneficiary within the family who is about to inherit monies and it will prejudice them and their life and their benefits if they inherit monies is another good example of why you might apply for a statutory will. That sort of application there is for another podcast on another day.
So the moral of the story is, if we all did a power of attorney when we're younger, most of the time that will see us through to our passing.
It will. And a power of attorney is cheaper, quicker, and you then actually control who you appoint as your attorney, whereas a deputy application, it's the deputy controlling who's managing those affairs and who makes that application. That might not have been the person you wanted to choose.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to Ellison's Connect, and many thanks to Anne for joining me in this episode. Any additional guides and insights we have mentioned today will be available on our website. We hope you found this episode insightful. If you'd like to discuss anything further on this subject, then please do get in touch via our website, ellisonsolicitors.com. Please don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on social media channels to keep up to date on the latest news and insights. Any information shared on this podcast was accurate at the time of recording. However, we advise speaking to your usual Ellison's advisor to make sure there hasn't been any changes since. Thank you to podtalk.co.uk for producing this podcast series.